Let's take just two lines of a poem or prose in any other language. This is the thought you can think in French that you can't think in English because there's no equivalent to it. There's a translator who taught me when I was a student, Stanley Korngold, who used to say, there's a kind of space in your head that you can live in where you're suspended between two languages. And I really wish we could communicate that.
You're listening to Speaking of Language, a podcast recorded at the Language Resource Center at Cornell University. Each week, we explore a topic related to language pedagogy and second language acquisition. This week, on Speaking of Language,
Caroline Levine joins us to discuss the challenges and revelations of translating poetry and how languages and the humanities can work as forces for social change.
Welcome to a new episode of Speaking of Language. I'm Angelica Kramer, the director of the Language Resource Center at Cornell University.
And I'm Sam Lupowitz, the LRC's media manager. We are joined today by Dr. Caroline Levine, the David and Kathleen Ryan Professor of Humanities at Cornell.
She will speak to us today about the challenges and idiosyncrasies in translating poetry, as well as her extensive career advocating for humanities and the arts.
Welcome to Speaking of Language, Caroline.
Great to be here.
So, Caroline, before we dive into all things poetry and translation, can you share with us a little bit about your own background and your path with languages?
Sure. So I grew up in a very eccentric family. Mm-hmm. My parents, both Americans, but they were passionately in love with European culture.
Nice.
And particularly, we could say European culture between 1350 and 1800.
Oh,
okay.
Everything after 1800 was fallen from their point of view. And I actually became a 19th century scholar.
Oh,
so although
funny.
I seem like I just followed in their footsteps, yeah. I'm actually a rebel. But neither of them was very good at languages. And so that was the thing I loved. I loved listening to the sounds of words. Mm-hmm. I loved listening to people, just ordinary people on the street speaking languages other
sure.
than English, but also all kinds of different dialects of English. And I just always loved that. And so from a pretty young age, they gave me some of the responsibility of trying to translate, sometimes in some complicated situations, like, you know, the French firefighters came because smoke was coming out of our windows, and I was, I don't know, 10, and I had to try to make the communication happen. So I was always a little bit stressed about speaking language, but I
sure.
still always just loved the sounds of it. So I started with French, and I learned some other European languages, Italian, some German, some Latin. But then, you know, in recent years, I've been really concerned about Eurocentrism in the academy and how little we
right.
are encouraged to study other languages, and I started to learn Arabic, and
nice.
I'm sorry to say I'm very bad at it, but my children are really good at it, so.
Wonderful. That's cool. Great. And what do you do here at Cornell?
So I teach in the English department, but I'm originally a comparative literature student,
mm-hmm.
and I have always been a little bit bothered by the national focus
mm-hmm.
of literary studies,
right.
and so I do a lot of well, I'm the 19th century editor for the Norton Anthology of World Literature,
mm-hmm.
and so I get to read outside of England and to think about literature as it's happening in
nice.
Vietnam and as it's happening in
yeah.
Africa and as it's happening in Latin America. And so I feel much happier in that kind of transnational space.
Great.
So that's a perfect segue into what we want to talk about today, because I know in your work as the 19th century editor for the Norton Anthology, you have a section in the upcoming edition where you investigate a work by Baudelaire and the challenges and revelations that come from translating a concentrated form of language like poetry. And since we talk a lot on our podcast about how language is culture is language, we thought we could chat with you about the ways this plays out in this example.
Definitely. So, it's a new kind of experiment in the Norton Anthology in all of the different volumes where we have what we call a translation lab.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the problems with teaching world literature in English is that, you know, students get a taste of lots of different kinds of literatures, but they often don't get a sense of the range of the languages.
Right.
And that's been a critique of world literature and a valid one for a long time. But so what we decided was that we would, in every volume, have one work in a not in English, and then have multiple translations so students could think about the difficulty and also the choices involved in translation.
Yeah. And
so ours in the 19th century is a poem by Baudelaire, Charles Baudelaire, who is the most widely read French poet in history.
Wow.
lots of people read him. Most people in his time read him in French, even all around the world, because French was a little bit more of a kind of educated person's language wherever you came from. But he's been rendered in English by a bunch of different poets with lots of different experiments in trying to translate him into English.
Can you summarize that original poem and talk a little bit more about the different translations?
Yeah, so I chose the poem, and I chose a deliberately controversial poem by Baudelaire, partly because I was interested in how translators would handle it. So Baudelaire had a long affair, like 20 years long affair with a woman of color named Jeanne Duval. She might have been born in Haiti, we're not sure, but she was at least partly of African descent. And he writes about her, and in this poem, which is called in French La Chevelure, which means head of hair, he writes about her hair, and he kind of exoticizes her hair and talks about its textures and the smell of perfume and how it takes him to Africa and India and all these exotic places.
Right.
It's basically a real objectification of a woman of color. A number of poets and writers and artists in our time have kind of written back to Baudelaire from Jeanne Duval's perspective and sort of thought, like, what is it like to be Jeanne Duval? And we've included a couple of those in our translation lab because, in a sense, you know, what Sam was saying, language is culture. Sometimes language doesn't carry all of culture. And so we wanted to have these other perspectives in there, too. So it's a poem about Jeanne Duval's hair. And the way that the poet in, you know, luxuriating in her hair has his own imagination carried away. But even the title, La Chevelure, is not really translated in, you can't really translate it into English. It Les cheveux is the ordinary word for hair in French. So La Chevelure is sort of like, it's a more massy kind of word. It means a mop or a or a massiveness of hair. And so part of what was interesting from the very beginning was, how are the translators going to translate the title? So one of them calls it The Fleece, which has got all kinds of other connotations in English. One calls it The Head of Hair. And then the third in our collection calls it just hair. But nobody says mop or, you know, which would be a very different kind of connotation than it is for Baudelaire, who's all about the luxurious, you know. But when you think about actual hair, like, sometimes it gets tangled and, you know, and so what is he actually evoking for us and how can we in English transmit that?
That's so interesting.
And one of the things, in addition to, I mean, just talking about translating the title and the issues and different connotations that that presents, then you get into the issue with poetry of meaning versus meter and how the different translators navigate that. Because what might be familiar or evoke a certain feeling rhythmically in French doesn't necessarily convey that same feeling in another language, whether that's English or what have you. Could you dig into that a little bit more with the examples that, that you have?
Absolutely. It's a great question, especially with Baudelaire. He uses the most traditional French meter, which is the Alexandrine, which is 12 syllables. And it doesn't feel right in English, the Alexandrine. Like, we, our standard poetic line length historically is 10 syllables, the iambic, and it has, in English, we have strong emphases on syllables of words. So, like, I say syllable, I don't say syllable, right? But in French, There's a much less of a kind of emphasis on individual syllables in given words. It's much kind of flatter language in that sense. And so the Alexandrine has a kind of, I mean, it's associated with kind of high culture, noble culture, but it also has this kind of soothing feeling that it's very hard to get across in English. And so the three translators we chose each took a different tack on the question of meter. And so you could kind of think about, like, which is the best one. So the first is a collaborative translation by George Dillon and Edna St. Vincent Millay, who, to my knowledge, is the only woman ever to have tried to translate this poem into English. And they try to do an Alexandrine kind of style in English. We have a second translation by Richard Howard, who does the iambic pentameter. He converts the standard, kind of classic French meter into the standard classic English meter. And then our third translator just does prose, you know, doesn't even try. And so I think part of the fun of the question of translation is to figure out how you're going to solve that particular problem. And it might, you know, everybody has different tastes, but I actually think that the iambic translation is the best. And I can't tell whether that's just because it happens to be the best poem or whether it's that that works the best, you know, that it kind of carries the right tone from the French across to the English.
Interesting.
One of the difficulties, this is back to the meanings rather than the meter, but one of the puzzles that people try to solve, the different translators try to solve with this poem, is that Baudelaire has a fantastic pun in the middle of the poem. He says forte tresse, which means strong tresses, like strong tresses of hair, but that's also a pun on fortress or fortresses.
Right.
And, like, there's no way to do it in English. Even though tresses works, fort doesn't quite work. And so, so one of the translators just has all these images of, like, military and prisons in there to try to carry the double meaning that's nowhere in the, you know, in the specific words that Baudelaire uses except for fortress.
Interesting.
What other pros and cons can you talk about in the different approaches? And what also is revealed by the different time periods of the translations and the translators? Because I know not only do you present us with three different versions of the translation, but each one is from a different era. So I'm tossing that back to you.
Yes, I love that question. You know, I think it's the best question about translation always, and the one that I probably fight with the most as a, in my own head, as a 19th century scholar, which is, do you translate a 19th century French or German or Spanish work of literature into language that sounds like its own time, like using a contemporary translation, or because it would have felt up to date to the people reading it, do you make it feel up to date to us? And I tend to be on the up to date side. I love the kind of freshness of a translation that gives us real access. And I feel like Emily Wilson's new translations of the Odyssey and the Iliad are perfect examples of that. She really has this kind of crisp English that feels like it flows the way, you know, it might have flowed to an ancient Greek audience. But so our first translation of Baudelaire's poem, the one by Edna St. Vincent Millay, is from the 1930s. And it feels kind of frilly to me. You know, it feels like it's over fancy. And Baudelaire was one of the things that's notable about him and hard for us readers now is that he wrote in what was called the style noble, which was the noble style, which or he at least wrote in that tradition, which was super fastidious about what kinds of words you could use. And like even nose was considered the word for, you know, the thing on your face was considered too mundane for the noble style. And so Baudelaire took from that, but then he deliberately put in these really shocking words like whore and pissing and these words that would, so he like, he's like right in there trying to make you feel incredibly uncomfortable about his word choices. And the Malay really doesn't do that. It softens it. It sweetens it. So it's interesting to find a woman translator on the one hand tackling this shocking modernist kind of poetry that doesn't abide by conventional norms, and on the other hand, not quite feeling able or free to give us what it feels like to read a Baudelaire poem if we're French contemporaries. I think one of the best lines in the poem that where you can kind of see how people are trying to, the three different translators are trying to capture Baudelaire's original, is, let me just read these two lines if this is okay.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Millet, it's actually two and a half lines. Millet writes, "To loose upon the midnight air the memories asleep in this tumultuous hair, I long to rake it in my fingers, tress by tress."
Mm.
So it's rhyming, it's mellifluous, it's a nice, pretty translation, right? Here's Richard Howard, 1982. "To people my dim cubicle tonight with memories shrouded in that head of hair, I'd have it flutter like a handkerchief."
Hmm. Oh,
well. So that's, right, it sounds like a different poem,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
A different poem. Yep. Let me give you the third one, which is from Keith Waldrop from 2006. "This evening, to populate our hideaway with the memories that sleep in your hair, I want to wave it in the air like a hanky."
Yeah, which... maybe more recognizable to being the same poem as the prior one, but still a very different impact.
Yes. The style is just so different. So which of those gets at the 19th century French the best? In some way, you could say none of them or all of them. They all have elements of it.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about what, thinking about these different translations, what this teaches us about engaging critically with the material?
Yeah, I love that question. I feel like, you know, the United States has been such a monolingual culture, kind of officially, not in fact, right? Mm-hmm. There have been people speaking all kinds of other languages all around us since the beginning. And, you know, certainly Spanish, I think, should be known and understood by all of us Americans.
Right.
So, you know, I feel like there's a political importance to polylingualism, multilingualism.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of what I'd love to get students interested in is just the difference between languages. Because I think when you just study language in high school and you get the faintest, barest sense, especially in a lot of U.S. high schools, of what another language might be made of, you get a lot of the feeling of frustration of like, why am I getting this wrong? This doesn't feel like it should translate, but it doesn't, and I don't understand, right? And so the monolingual context, part of the way I could imagine challenging it is by thinking about translation and getting students to think about, you know, let's take just two lines of a poem or prose in any other language and think, have maybe somebody in the room who knows something about that language. I don't think you need to know it well or deeply, but just to be able to say, oh, this is how it works differently. And this is how it, you know, this is the thought you can think in French that you can't think in English because there's no equivalent to it. There's a translator who taught me when I was a student, Stanley Korngold, who used to say, there's a kind of space in your head that you can live in where you're suspended between two languages. And I really wish we could communicate that because I think it's a cool space. And I also think it's a place where, you know, our usual language learning doesn't really get us. And, you know, it's partly also something that I've learned from David Damrosch, who's a world literature scholar, about sort of not having to be fluent in another language in order to get its difference from ours, and that's something that we could do more of in the world literature classroom, you know, bringing in little bits about, you know, I once heard a fantastic talk by somebody about a Chinese poem who pointed out that there were a lot of characters in Chinese that had, it was a poem about moonlight, and a lot of the characters had words that were connected to light in some way visually. And so it was a visual pun that you can't make in English because the shape of our letters doesn't communicate in the same way. And so just having that knowledge can open up this kind of world of difference to us.
Beautiful. Well, in addition to your work on the Norton Anthology, you're the author of 4 books of your own. I know a recurring theme in your work is the social necessity of humanities and the arts. What can you share with our listeners, especially language instructors, about your approach to humanities as a force for social change?
Oh, such a great question. I mean, I think what I've been saying about sort of the politics of language learning is feels very important to me, you know, at a moment, especially when languages are disappearing across the world, in some ways, at a rate that's like species extinction. The fact that we often don't know or understand or appreciate the worlds that come with each language, I think, is going to create a kind of cultural loss in a way that we're not even recognizing or aware of. And it's not that any of us can learn all the world's languages, but even learning one or two can help open our minds to why that is a value. So just the diversity of the world's cultures, the ways in which people think that is different from a dominant worldview in our own place and time, that just feels like nourishing and opening us up to alternative ways of living that we need urgently now. I guess I think about art and the arts in a broader sense, too, to think about how there's a long tradition of art and artists challenging mainstream culture and just trying to kind of dislodge us from our routine assumptions and expectations by playing with language and stretching it and stretching our sense of perception and inviting us to think new thoughts. And in recent years, I've been making really almost like the opposite argument too, which is in this moment of climate catastrophe, we also need to be thinking about continuity and making sure that we are protecting and preserving our cultural many cultural heritages, not one, but many of them, and as well as our infrastructures and our ways of living. And so the humanities has thought both of those questions, both preservation and disruption. And I would like us to keep thinking about those as kind of urgent needs in our own moment.
Well, and one of your recent books titled The Activist Humanist, Form and Method in the Climate Crisis, actually focuses on that. Recently, we had another Cornell colleague here on our podcast, Carolyn Fornoff, who researches the intersection of art and climate change in Latin America. Can you talk a little bit more about this aspect of your work and any specific takeaways for our listeners?
Sure. So I have been working on an argument about methods in the humanities, less about what they're about, you know. So I don't study artworks that are works of literature that represent climate change. I think more about how our training as literary scholars can help us to bring a certain set of analytic tools to the world outside of the arts. And that method, which has a long history in literary studies, musicology, and art history, is formalism. And that is kind of a traditional formalism, looks at the shapes and structures and arrangements that make a work of art go, whether that's meter in poetry or vanishing point perspective in painting. And so we're actually very skilled, and we learn these skills in the classroom and we teach them, of finding patterns and arrangements in works of art. And I think we can bring that set of skills, for example, to public transportation systems and to think about how they function. And so to look at our world as made up of lots of different designs and arrangements, not traditionally artistic, but still with the skills that we have, we're able to analyze them. So one of the things that's going on right now in the climate crisis is that a lot of the kind of basic structures of our lives are under threat. Basic things like clean water, nutritious food, stable shelter. And we live in a world which is often been very insistent on innovation and novelty and disruption. And you hear that in, like, you know, the tech world. It's all about innovation and disruption. But actually, we need stability. And what are the forms, the kind of material forms that help to keep us alive?
Yeah.
And what do we need to preserve against the pressures of, like, what's also destruction, you know, and innovation? So it's been interesting work to kind of say, look, we literary scholars have something to offer to political and social conversations about climate change. And odd, you know, on the one hand, some of my literary scholar friends are kind of like, wait, what are you doing? You're leaving literature behind. You're abandoning us. And on the other hand, I think in the sciences and the social sciences, there's been an interest in what this might look like. And so I think it's actually worth imagining this as one of the capacities that humanities students and scholars have that we have undervalued that could make us really important interlocutors in this really crucial moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fantastic. What other projects are you currently working on? Anything else you'd like to share with us?
Well, you know, my question about what humanities have to offer to climate change has brought me to an answer, which is also, I think, really not a standard answer. One might say eccentric. One might say unpersuasive. It's the answer I came to, which is that we really should be taking action. We should be connecting our work to taking action. So I've become an activist, a climate activist, and I spend a lot of time thinking about climate activism. That is, it's not just I stopped being an academic and started doing activism. It's more like, what do my humanities skills bring to this work?
Nice.
And conversely, what does activism help me to understand as a humanist?
Mm-hmm.
And the project that I'm working on right now, and thinking, theorizing, and also strategizing, is around the pension funds that are major drivers of the climate crisis right now. That is, they're pouring money into building new pipelines and coal mines and oil rigs right now against every warning from the IPCC. One of them is actually, it's founded as a pension fund for teachers, and most faculty across the United States our pension money is going into driving the climate crisis. So that's TIAA, the Teachers Insurance and Annuity Association. And at Cornell, most of us have TIAA for our pension funds, and we have no idea that our own hard-earned money is going into driving the climate crisis. So I've been thinking a lot about forms of collective pressure, forms of communication, what kinds of ways do we actually get the word out to people? TIAA said to us at one point, oh, our clients don't complain. And I thought to myself, well, they really would if they knew, but we don't know, right? Because they're very secretive, they're very untransparent. And so, you know, I write about this in my scholarly work, and I also do the actions, and I see them in a kind of feedback loop now. But I'd also love to get the word out to the podcast listeners to think about where your pension money might be going and how you might not want it to go. And if you want to join our group, it's called TIA Divest. We're all volunteers. So, you know, it's not we welcome all support and participation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. The MLA just sent out an email about a resolution that they drafted to all their members.
I wrote that resolution.
Ah, well, look at that. That's awesome. That is fantastic. Where can our listeners find out more about you and your work?
Oh, gosh. Well, on the Cornell English webpage, I have a bio, and it has some links to my work. One of the things I haven't done yet, and I mean to do, is to put some links to publicly available works on my website. So I haven't done that yet. But I would love to share more work with readers and listeners. I would recommend to people who might think about teaching world literature that the Norton Anthology, you can get a teacher's copy. And a free edition to think about it and look at it. We're very excited by how we're updating it with each edition. We've got more and more global literature from, you know, places that hadn't been represented in earlier volumes. And we really love feedback from people who are teaching in translation, teaching world literatures, you know, even recommending texts from their own fields of specialty. So I'd love to get the word out, too, about how much we'd like to hear from teachers of literature around the world.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Oh, fantastic. Caroline, this has been a wonderful conversation. Before we sign off, we first want to plug our own poetry event, Sweet Poetry, which will take place this afternoon, April 17th, from 5 to 7 p.m. in the Klarman Atrium at Cornell. Join us for a multilingual celebration of poetry and support our students who will read and sign their favorite poems.
And last, as lovers of words, we would like to ask you to share a word in a language that you speak, you love, you are learning, you may want to learn, that doesn't exist in English, but you wish it did.
Well, so I hope this isn't cheating, but I have a word for Middle English
didn't
make it into modern English.
Love it. That's a new, I don't think we've had English one yet.
I don't think so either. That's awesome.
I just learned this from a medievalist named Nicholas Watson. The word is Leaflede, and it means everything you need to survive. It means, you know, shelter, food, water. And I thought, we really need that to think about climate change. We need Leaflede for everyone.
I like it.
I like that. Yeah, it's much more musical than what my undergrad advisor used to simply refer to as that pesky food and shelter addiction. Well, this has been such a treat. Thank you very much for speaking of language with us today, Caroline.
Thank you for having me.
Join us next week to hear from Dr. Dan Nicolai, this semester's final presenter in our LRC speaker series. You can go to our website and watch his talk about iSprach, a platform for second language pronunciation instruction, assessment, and research. Then you'll be prepared to catch his podcast episode next week.
Until then,
auf Wiederhören.
The Language Resource Center is located on the ground floor of Stimson Hall on Cornell's main campus in Ithaca, New York. Check us out on the web at lrc.cornell.edu.
And follow Cornell LRC on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Speaking of Language is produced by Angelica Kramer and Sam Lupowitz.
Recorded by Sam Lupowitz.
Original music by Sam Lupowitz, Dan Gable, and Joe Gibson.
Thanks also to the College of Arts and Sciences at Cornell University.
As a reminder, the ideas and opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect those of the College of Arts and Sciences or any other official entity of Cornell University.
We thank our listeners, and do stay tuned for our next episode.